Okay, it's recording. This is Dana Lombardi, and I am giving a talk on Crippled from the Start, Nazi Germany and the Treaty of Versailles, and how World War II was affected by the Treaty of Versailles, which was signed in 1919. And I'm doing this talk at Celesticon 2012.
The Treaty of Versailles, once it was all done and signed, was published in many different languages, including English. And this is the English version, as you see here, but they all had these books. Literally, it was a book because there were 75,000 words in this document. 75,000 words in a 200 pages printed. There were 440 articles that were covered. Only 12% of those articles, 54 of them, actually dealt with Germany's military forces. The rest had to deal with borders and political issues and monetary compensation that Germany would have to pay and all these sort of things. So it's an enormous document. And I have a confession. I have not read the entire document. I just have not. Neither did they. Okay? Yes, that's Prime Minister David Lloyd George, Prime Minister George Clemenceau, and President Woodrow Wilson. They did not read this entire document. Either, this is not, I'm not making this up. They didn't because they had.
I think a lot of people did.
Well, the staffs did. The staffs went over this very carefully. They went through all this. What these guys did is the big issue stuff. Okay, they made the big decisions about whether there would be a Poland, whether there would be an Austria-Hungary, or whether it would be broken up, how much of Germany was going to be lost, and things like that. And then they let their staffs work out a lot of little details. But these guys are going to set the tone for the entire thing. And it's really important to understand where they're coming from. Wilson is regarded as a dreamer in some respects, and he has a big dream about the League of Nations that will prevent wars in the future. He wants this to be more than just about retribution, about just divvying up the spoils at the end of a war. But both Clemenceau and George's have a real problem with their own people because... And this is a political issue, and it's enormously important for us to understand, is that Wilson could afford to be a little bit more philosophical because the United States did not have the kind of devastation in terms of the number of men killed and wounded, or certainly none of our property or our land had been devastated either. Nothing in America had been hit other than some sabotages and factories. But George and Clemenceau had to go to their own people. Okay, they had to go to their people and say, why were we doing this? What are we getting out of it? And if you go to your people and you say, well, you know, all these millions of men who were dead and maimed terribly for life, and the property, and especially in France, the devastation, we're not going to be tough on Germany because we don't want this to happen again. So what we're going to do is we're going to be, you know, we're going to try and be fair and think of the future. These guys are gone. The next election, they're out. They're finished. So they had to say, I mean, George got in the position he's in it because he promised the Germans, the Huns will pay. They will pay for this. Not only did they start it, but they're going to pay. So the idea that the Versailles Treaty could be anything from their standpoint, politically, other than this punishment on Germany, I don't think is realistic, and I don't think it's possible. So after the war, and Frank had mentioned this in an earlier thing, there's a whole bunch of countries in Eastern Europe that end up either shrinking. Bulgaria, which served, you know, which fought with Germany and Austria-Hungary, loses territory. Romania, which gains territory because it fought with the Allies. Yugoslavia comes into existence because that's basically Montenegro and Serbia and other areas combined. Czechoslovakia is broken off from Austria-Hungarian Empire, and Austria and Hungary now finally separate officially. And Poland comes into existence, which has always had been back and forth between a lot of partitions, but it comes into existence by taking part of Germany, part of Russia, part of Austria-Hungary, and so... That's a huge change in the map of Europe. And the reason this is so important is, think about this, there have been a lot of wars in Europe, a lot of wars. We know about Napoleonic Wars, Crimean War. No one ever said we are going to destroy somebody's empire, literally destroy it. Napoleon was going to defeat Russia if he had accomplished his mission, but he wasn't going to break it up into a whole bunch of little countries. He defeated Prussia, but he didn't destroy it, and he defeated Austria-Hungary. He never intended to do something like this. So this is unprecedented, and normally Britain wouldn't want to have a nation that's a powerful empire. In fact, one of the oldest dynasties in Europe, the Austro-Hungarians, suddenly broken into little parts like this. This is like really unprecedented. So Germany itself, as you see, loses this. One of the big reasons that France fights Germany in World War I is because they want to regain Alsace and Lorraine, the territories they lost in the Franco-Prussian War. So they do get those back. And plus the Rhineland is demilitarized, and they keep control of that, so that part of the reparations that they get. And then in the West, now East Prussia has been separated by the rest of Germany by having Danzig, an independent, neutral territory, and then Poland grabbing territory. So, and also Germany was forbidden to unite with Austria. That's very important. It was forbidden by the Versailles Treaty to do that. So, and of course we know Germany loses all of its overseas possessions. So in Africa, it goes to Britain. In the Pacific, Japan's bonus for going in on the side of the Allies is they get the Bismarck Island chains and the others. So they end up with a lot of territory as well. But there's another thing that Germany loses. A lot of people don't realize all of their patents and secrets are gone. Dow Chemical and a lot of other American firms benefit by getting all these things. We don't have to pay a royalty anymore. Woo-hoo! All these great German dyes and all this other stuff, it's now ours. So we benefit. So there's, you can see that territorially and then commercially and financially, the countries that win, the ones that are on the winning side, benefit, including the United States. And this is a huge thing. Again, this is not necessarily different from any prior war, okay? But it's done on a scale here that is unprecedented, because the scale of the Great War has been unprecedented. Okay, so the treaty, however, is the harshest on the military itself, and these guys are typical late war German soldiers. The army is reduced by the treaty to only 100,000 men. You've probably heard this many times. In 1914, there were 3 million. Okay, 3 million guys, so it's down to 100,000 men, and they could only have 4,000 officers maximum, officers, all ranks, lieutenants up to generals, to basically control this. So it's going to be a police force more than anything else. They can only have 7 infantry divisions and 3 cavalry divisions. Again, more like a police force. Whereas in 1918, the German army had 251 divisions, and now they can only have 10. Okay, and this is also important. They can only be volunteer. The guys have to volunteer for the army. That's the only way it can be accepted. You cannot have compulsory conscription. In other words, there's no draft. You can't just draft people into the army like they did in World War I. Okay, that cripples the manpower part of it. There was a limit on machine guns, mortars. That's a very early trench mortar. And also a limit on even rifles and ammunition. In other words, how much you could have. They could still have machine guns, they could still have mortars, but just not a lot. So there are limits on that. This is actually Fort Douaumont at Verdun, the French fort. But Germany was not allowed to build fortifications. It wasn't allowed to make any of these forts. Okay, so the Siegfried Line that we know comes in later is a direct violation of the Versailles Treaty. No artillery is allowed to be bigger than 105 millimeter. That's actually a 210, okay? And they have even bigger ones, obviously. But the really big killer of World War I is going to be your artillery. And so they're forbidden to have anything bigger than a 105. And ships. No ship can be larger than 10,000 tons. And this gives you a comparison. A U.S. four-stack destroyer was only 1,000 tons. So they could obviously have destroyers. And one of the old, obsolete battleships, the Deutschland in World War I, was 13,000. They couldn't have that again. So you can have something bigger than a destroyer, but you can't have a battleship. Just cannot have it. Now keep in mind, in World War II, we're going to have battleships that are 40,000, 50,000 tons. They're going to get enormous, and aircraft carriers are too. So the 10,000 ton limit is to allow you enough of a navy to protect your own shores and have destroyers and stuff, but nothing that would really contest the British Navy or the American Navy. Now these are absolutely forbidden. Not the Fokker D-7, but aircraft, military aircraft. You cannot have any military aircraft. The horses and the guy with the gas mask represent gas. You can't have any kind of poison gas. No gas whatsoever. No submarines, all gone. No submarines are allowed at all. And the tank there, even though the A7 was not very good, they still couldn't have that because they could see. They knew that these things were going to get better. And if they allowed Germany to improve it, they would be equal to their military power. So all those things, absolutely, under any circumstances, not allowed. Okay, in addition, we want you to pay for the war. You caused it. You caused the damages. You started the war. You've got to pay for it. This is an ad. This is not an ad, but a editorial cartoon from the time, from the New York World newspaper, that just shows that Americans were like, you've got to be kidding me, $55 billion. Billion dollars in 1919. Okay, it was a figure that most people couldn't even comprehend. Okay, and it says, "Let's see you collect it." It's like you're crushing a coal worker here, right? It's like, okay, you can put anything you want to impose on us, but we can't pay it. This is at the time people thought this is insane. How can you do this? Because you'll never get this money. Which, by the way, they never did, but that's another story. Again, and Germany looks at this. This is our glorious German maiden, right? Stripped almost naked with her blonde locks. The wolves in the background, right? Representing the rest of Europe. Her broken sword, the crown of the Kaiser, thrown on the ground because he's been thrown out. And This is the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, Robert Lansing, said this, that the Treaty of Versailles is immeasurably harsh and humiliating. And this is a picture that Germany had like in a book at the time about how they felt about it. So you can imagine, there's no one that's saying this is fair and reasonable, right? We're saying this is outrageous. Germany is saying it's outrageous. And basically, politically, they don't have a choice. They have to do this. They have to go after it and get what they can. Even if they know they're never going to collect all that money, they have to tell their people, I want to keep my job as a politician. I don't want my people to throw me out by saying I'm weak. So I've got to show strength. And this is what, at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Dwight Eisenhower, who stayed in the United States and was training our tank force, his buddy George Patton went over and, of course, was, you know, in the operations, combat operations of the Argonne. But Eisenhower was, this is what he thought at the time. The Treaty of Versailles had practically guaranteed the outbreak of another great war. Even the military men said, this is a disaster. So here you got everybody, even astute politicians saying, this treaty is stupid. It's not going to guarantee peace. Okay, and this book by Margaret McMillan is absolutely fantastic. Paris 1919 tells you the story of how they were trying to come up with this treaty, all the different motivations, and she wrote that later it became commonplace to blame everything that went wrong in the 1920s and 1930s on the peacemakers and the settlements they made in Paris in 1919. That's not fair, but again, you can see why a lot of people at the time looked back from the 20s and the 30s and said, those idiots, this treaty is just the worst possible thing. So no one's ever said that the Treaty of Versailles is a good thing. It's always been a disaster. We all know him, okay? And again, she said, Hitler did not wage war because of the Treaty of Versailles, although he found its existence a godsend to his propaganda, and he did. You know, it's like, look what they've done to us. We have to throw off this yoke. We have to reassert our position in Europe and in history, right? And that resonated with a lot of people. Even people who were not Nazis in Germany were like, yeah, this is BS. Why do we have to put up with this? This is what it did. That is the German army in World War II. I know a lot of you play, you know, Men Under Fire and Flames of War and everything else, and these are not the things you're moving across the table. Right? Tiger tanks, half tracks, reconnaissance cars, and so forth. But this is it, guys, okay? For 15 years, because of the treaty, from 1919 to 1934, German industrial capacity was severely limited. That's an understatement. It was stopped. It was just slammed to the ground. Krupp stopped making guns because no one was going to buy them. Okay, I mean, the only way to survive was to start making other things. There's no aircraft industry at all. If you are a good German aircraft designer, you go someplace else. If you're a weapons designer, you absolutely go somewhere else. The Bofors, any aircraft weapon that's used by many different sides in World War II is invented by a German who went to Sweden. Because, again, there's no jobs for him in Germany at this time. So this period, and the reason 1934 is because that's when the Nazis come to power. That's when Hitler starts. Because 33 is when he's put into office in January. But it takes a year to consolidate power and to basically decide to throw off the Versailles Treaty and then start the industry, which has been zero, is now going to start building tanks, now going to start building aircraft for military purposes, now going to start building artillery again, okay? And remember, you have no experience for this for 15 years doing this. And all of your experts, your brain drain has left the country. One of the things Hitler is going to do is he's going to have this this call to Germans who had left and gone to America and other places to come back to Germany, and we're going to pay your way, make it good for your family, get you great jobs here. And so the brain drain is able to reverse a little bit. But a lot of the guys said, no, no, not going back. We're fine where we are. That impacts you. And why is that important? Okay. We also had a very bad experience in World War I as the United States. U.S. industrial mobilization was studied throughout the 1920s and 1930s. And the reason that was is it's a reaction to the U.S. production scandals and the incompetence of the so-called War Industries Board that was created in 1917. When we went to war, the last wars that we had was the Spanish-American War, and before that, what, the Indian Wars and the American Civil War. We had no huge industry supporting our own efforts. There were people that were making a lot of money off of supporting the British. The British ordered the rifles being made in our country and other things. And those guys, because of the profit, did a great job. But now our army needs tanks. Our army needs airplanes and so forth. Okay, now these are tanks in World War II. These are grants being made. But in World War I, we never made our own combat aircraft. We had the Jenny, and we made engines for the other Allied aircraft. We never made our own combat aircraft. Never. We never made our own tank. We made tanks under license, but we never were able to get our own tank out there. And a lot of the artillery, same thing. We used whatever the Allies gave us. Now, you would think, well, how bad is it? Well, we were there for almost 2 years. In that period, we didn't make one of them. It was a huge political embarrassment. And because of this problem, we said, we can't afford this. So our army actually set up a department and worked with the industry directly to figure out how to go into production and make the things we needed if there was another war, because everybody was thinking there's going to be another war. There's no such thing in Germany for those 15 years. There's not one person studying this. Yes, they do have an army that's studying how to get the army back up to a certain level. They know how to basically train their men. They're developing tactics and theories of tactics and so forth. But this is what's going to be a huge influence in World War II, is going to be industrial capacity, being able to make stuff, especially war things. And the Germans don't have that. Here's another thing we did a lot of. Look at that. It goes off into infinity. It's a B-24 heavy bombers. It just goes off into a factory that's been thrown up and just is amazing. Now, this is a statement by Stalin. I want you to notice the date. It's December of 43. The Allies should know that they're winning, okay? And this is what Joseph Stalin is recorded as having said through his translator at the Tehran conference. I want to tell you from the Russian point of view what the President and the United States have done to win the war. We're winning the war. The most important things in this war are machines. The United States has proven that it can turn out from 8,000 to 10,000 airplanes per month. Russia can turn out only at most 3,000 airplanes a month. The United States, therefore, is a country of machines. Without the use of those machines through Lend-Lease, we would lose this war. That's Joseph Stalin saying this. Okay? Without the tools we need to win the war, we could never defeat Nazi Germany. And what's the one thing Nazi Germany is not going to be able to compete with? It will never be able to produce these kinds of numbers during World War II. It'll never have, you know, as many aircraft, as many tanks, as many jeeps, or anything. And it's because we had totally learned from World War I that we have to do this differently. And Stalin had industrialized and modernized his country, a lot of it hideously, because it really was a terrible strain on the people and on their economy. But again, he's able to crank out tens of thousands of tanks as well, whereas Germany cannot do it. In fact, Stalin has another great saying. There is a certain quality in quantity, okay? And we may laugh about that, but the fact is that the Allies, the United States, and Soviet Union in particular, are going to produce an overwhelming amount of material that is going to be able to support their military, and it's that huge. In fact, there's a book written, Brute Force, that talks about this, that basically the Allies in World War II are just going to crush Germany under the weight of all the stuff. We didn't have to be better. And there's a big debate, and Frank and I have talked about this. I believe the United States Army became the best army in World War II. And I think that the Russians improved dramatically as well. They couldn't defeat the Germans without it. But it was also the huge amount of material superiority in terms of artillery, ammunition, everything else that we're able to bring to bear that is going to win the war. So the quantity is, in fact, a type of quality, and Germany can't get it. It can't, no matter what it does, it's not going to get it because of the imposition of the limits of the Treaty of Versailles. Now, we know when we look about, like I go back to the flames of war and men under fire and everything, is that this is what we're looking at. Oh, yeah, Tiger tank, Panther tank. That's what we know about the German army and the armored forces in World War II.
I think it was Mark IV.
No, it's the Mark IV and the Mark II, okay? And that's what was really what they had to work with through the first 3 years of the war.
What about the Mark III?
Well, they're medium tank like the Mark IV. Okay, I'm not trying to list them all, but I'm trying to show the two different types. You had light tanks, the ones and the twos, and you had medium tanks, the threes and the fours, okay? Now, here are some numbers, and this is what tells the story really, really good. Just the basic totals. If you look at the bottom, you can see the U.S. of A. did 88,000 tanks in World War II. The Soviet Union, 125,000 tanks. Even the United Kingdom did almost 25,000 tanks. So the Allies were able to produce 238,000 tanks. And Germany, for the entire war, every armored vehicle you can think of is going to be about 32,000 tanks. So you've got, what is that, an almost 4-to-1, right, ratio of the Allies being able to outproduce Germany.
What
42,000.
Hmm?
Didn't they say 42,000?
What, where? 32,000.
Oh, I see.
All the way over there.
Yeah. Yes.
Only from the top.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Those are actually... I subtracted out all the light tankettes.
Oh.
Okay. I take the left side. But yes. Yes. All right. Okay. So Frank, stop trying to do my lecture. Anyway, so... Okay. So... Yes, you can see the different types. There's the Panzer I, the Panzer II, the Czech 38 and 35, Panzer III, Panzer IV. If you look at it, look, there's no Panther or Tiger. And the Tiger comes in at the end of 42. It's the first time it's going to show up. But up to that point, what Germany is using from the invasion of Poland, the invasion of the West and Norway, the invasion of Soviet Union, and that second season in the Soviet Union of campaigning, they have, like, 5,000 vehicles they've manufactured, and that's it. I mean, this is just astonishing that they're doing this. Imagine had they had, like everybody else, armor all through the 20s and 30s that they could develop, improve on, and do more with. So they wouldn't be sitting there with Mark 1s and Mark 2s trying to outdo... they're not going to outdo the Allied armor. They always talk about this. T-44 was a shock. It's much better... better armor, better gun, and so forth. The Germans had to make do with either their aircraft capability, their radios, which allowed them to coordinate things. It's amazing they got as far as they did, considering that they don't have as good of weapons as the Allies. When they start getting the good stuff, it's already too late. But it takes this long to develop things. It takes years. We also know that the Air Force is critical, and the 109... First flies in 1935, that's a year after the Nazis decided to rearm, okay? It's prototype flies, and when it flies as a prototype, it uses a Rolls-Royce engine. Because Germany can't make aircraft engines yet, not powerful ones, because again, they were forbidden to do so. And it takes a long time for an aircraft to go from design to development to production to working out the budget until you can get it. And that Junkers Ju-52 had been a civilian designed passenger carrier before the war. And why is it there? Because they don't have the capability to design everything from scratch. They got to use whatever they can, and they do it makeshift-wise. They convert it into a military aircraft. It's a bomber, okay? It's a paratroop carrier. It's a supply aircraft. And that, by the way, is going to be the same thing they're using for in 1945. They cannot stop production on everything. They have to keep making some of the same things because it is so costly, and it interrupts so much to try and convert these factories into doing more sophisticated weapons. Here are the numbers. Now, this is the curious thing, is that all through the war, you can see the dates, and over there is the total number. The German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, is able to maintain a strength of around 4,000 aircraft. That includes all types, you can see. Now, it does change. You can see that the bombers start off heady and then end up being very small in 45 because mostly they're going ground attack, which makes sense. They're trying to stop the Allied armies and their armored forces. Fighters increase in number. Twin fighters, those are the ones used at night fighting, also increase. You can see that as the war goes on. But Germany, through the entire war, builds 120,000 aircraft. And the Allies, again, do 593,000 aircraft. And I threw in Japan's numbers of 76,000 simply because I was astounded. Now, Japan is not known as a major industrial society at the time. They did some great shipbuilding. They were able to do that. But the fact that they could crank 76,000 aircraft is really an embarrassment for the Germans when you think about it, right? And one of the advantages is that Japan was untouched. We couldn't reach it to bomb it until late 44. And 45 is when we really ratcheted it up. But they're able to produce a substantial number of aircraft, even in Japan, and Germany just was not able to produce on a level that made them competitive to the Allies. There's another thing that's a problem. This is the heavy cruiser Lützow, and you can see that it got hit by a torpedo. It didn't sink, but it cracked the welds. It's like it's gonna lose the rear end of the ship here, right? This happened several times. It happened with the Prince Eugen. It happened with this. Why did this happen? They're not making ships this big during the interwar period. They're just not.
They lost the technology.
Yep, bingo. If you were a really good welder and you knew how to do this, if you wanted to keep your job, you went to Ireland to work for the British shipbuilding, or you went to Liverpool, or you went to the United States. I mean, you went someplace where you could use your skills. So Germany is playing catch-up from 34 on. Yeah, you can launch these ships, but there are serious flaws with this, with the engine technology. There are a lot of things that make it difficult for their warships to stand up to the same rigors as the Allied ships. And then this is my answer to how do you avoid World War II after all this? Break up Germany. Hitler was able to take basically an intact Germany and start rebuilding immediately. He barely got anything going, as you can see. But it was almost enough to not only conquer most of Europe, he almost knocked out Russia before, you know, massive aid saved their bacon. And if Britain didn't have the channel, they would have been gone too long before the United States came into the war. So how do you prevent Hitler from doing this or from Germany ever doing it again? Break it up. Now you can say, well, wait a minute, why do that? Well, it was not even a full nation until 1871. You know, Bavaria was a separate state. There were other places that did not like Prussia and were not happy about being under the Prussian influence. So Turkey was totally cut up into a whole bunch of states, as we know. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, and all these other places. Austria-Hungary was absolutely just cut into a whole bunch of pieces. Had they done that, and even if the Nazis had come out of Bavaria and taken that over, that's just one German state. It is not the entire German nation, which still had enough power, which still had enough people and which still had enough industrial capacity to play catch-up from 1934 on to be able to launch that war. And a lot of the weapons they did, like the 109 and those medium tanks, were good enough to fight in the first 3 years of the war. But once the technological achievements came in on the Allied side, Germany just could never produce enough. At the end of the war, they only had a couple of hundred ME-262s. That's it. And they couldn't even fly them because they didn't have the fuel to train the guys. They couldn't keep them up. But they couldn't get those in until 1945. So this is basically the only solution. And some people also say, well, what about the Treaty of Versailles? Like I said, I don't think you could ever have any other kind of treaty other than what was written. How harsh it was, I don't think it was harsh enough. Had they thought about it, and actually, Clemenceau thought about this. And at this point, he had had a falling out with Woodrow Wilson. And Wilson was fed up. And he says, I don't want to hear any more about this. But Clemenceau said, let's break them up into their separate states like they had before 1871. Because that will prevent them from being able to. It would take them years to reunify, even assuming they could do that, and then before they'd be able to start another war. It might buy them another 20 years or so. So this is really the only direction you can go. You can't make it. Yes, go ahead, Frank.
It's worth saying, noting that actually did work after World War II.
Yes, it did work after World War II. Germany is now two separate states and an independent Berlin, right? Yes, people said, no, this is not ever happening again, right? So, yes, that is exactly what they did.
They have total economic domination over Europe.
Yes, so they've conquered Europe anyway, but they did it probably the best way, which is economically rather than with military force. But at the time, this is not Dana thinking of this well after the fact, I have hindsight. Clemenceau actually suggested this, and Woodrow Wilson shot it down at the time because they were just, not having a good day. But again, you can see that I don't believe that the Versailles Treaty could have ever been fair from the German standpoint. In fact, it would have worked exactly the opposite. Think about this. I'm going to leave you as much as possible of your territories overseas. I'm not going to put reparations on you. You're going to have to reduce the size of your army, but we're not going to really slam you about this. The Nazis would have had a feeling, of course we were winning World War I. Why would they let us off so easy if we weren't like kicking the crap out of them? So you can't win that argument. So if you're going to try and truly prevent a nation from getting back up, the Romans realized when Carthage got back up and was threatening them, he's like, no, that's it. There's not going to be a Carthage, right? It's gone. And guess what? There's never a threat from Carthage ever again. So this is Clemenceau's thing, is that the best way to prevent Germany from ever threatening us again, don't have a Germany, not as we know it. Cut it up. And then Frank is absolutely correct. That's what we did after World War II. And guess what? We didn't have that problem again. So
until they reunified.
Well, they're not militarily dominating now. They're just telling everybody what to do with their money. The Germans conquered eventually, but not the way
they did. They're mostly talking about to do with German money.
Right, what they're going to do with German money.
Well, Japan did basically do the same thing. it's now financially, even though it's still in the hole, it's done more than what it did during the war.
Japan has a totally different set of issues, and it was affected positively by the Treaty of Versailles because it ended up with territory and so forth, because it wasn't on the losing side. And deciding to go forward with World War II, the Pacific War, as they call it, was a disaster for them. But I was going to focus this solely on the German episode. And I think it's pretty obvious that taking away somebody's industrial capacity, as they did with the Treaty of Versailles, absolutely did affect them. And it's my premise here that it crippled Germany from the very beginning. They could never catch up. And what's a miracle is how far they were able to get with basically a thrown-together air force, really half-assed armored force, but led and coordinated in a way that was vastly ahead of their opponents, with radios in particular. When the French are waving at each other with flags from one tank to another to try and communicate, the Germans are not only communicating between tanks, but communicating to battalion headquarters, communicating to the Luftwaffe, and in the tank itself, I'm talking through my throat mic to all my guys telling them what to do. I don't have to like tap him on the left shoulder to let him know to go left. Even though the tank is inferior to what I'm up against, it allows me to coordinate my forces and do things that the other side simply cannot do. And I think that that is why they were able to get as far as they did, even though it wasn't through sheer numbers. The Luftwaffe certainly didn't crush the opposition. Even in Poland, I think you've done this, Frank, where the Polish Air Force gave a great account of themselves.
If you look back at your totals of German aircraft, look at the total for 1939.
Yes, that's the first day of the Poland, right.
Look at the total for 1940.
It goes down.
It goes down.
And that is Eagle Day. That's,
wow! Yeah, yes. That's a big drop.
Yes, it is.
It's 1,000 aircraft.
Yes.
Because the Poles did an excellent job in the air.
And so, and the British and French did not, there were no slouches in the 1940 campaign. And it takes time not only to make the aircraft to replace them, it also takes time to train pilots. You can't just throw these guys out there because they're going to get shot down really fast. So, yes, they lost so many aircraft and so many pilots in that time that the actual net strength of the Luftwaffe drops by the time of Eagle Day, which is the big hit on England in the Battle of Britain. Yes?
If I'm reading the numbers right, Germany's total production of war is 120,000.
Yes.
Which is slightly less than the UK. Right. So, it looks to me, no matter, even aside from Versailles, even if Germany had full production capacity, their population was slightly larger than the UK's. They maybe could have had slightly more planes than the UK. Maybe, let's say, they'd get up to 150,000. The USSR and the US United States are still going to crush them, completely overwhelm them, simply because those two countries are so much bigger.
And that is the argument,
right.
Is that
Germany,
right. I think the main issue here is, I think the main issue here is that if Germany were able to, the war would have actually broken out earlier. In fact, Mussolini, who I didn't even mention, had a very modern air force and military in the early 30s. And that's what he gambled on. We're going to have a war in the 30s, right? In the late 30s. And instead of 1939, had Germany had all these advantages, they might have gone up against, they wouldn't have been up against Spitfires. Even the Hurricane was an advanced air. They would have been up against Bristol bullfighters. They would have been up against biplanes in Britain. Because remember, everyone's still going to suffer through the Great Depression. Everyone is going to get hammered, including Germany. So, Britain goes through it worse than some other countries, and France disintegrates internally because of all its political infighting, so that it doesn't even have an air force to really consider for World War II purposes. So, if Germany had had more and better, they might have had it more and better before the others. And instead of the Civil War in Spain focusing everyone's attention, it might have been the war breaks out then.
Right. So Germany might have taken out France and maybe the UK.
Well, I think the game is over at that point. If they negotiate, because Neville Chamberlain is the Prime Minister,
right.
The reason he made his deal in Prague, right, in Munich, or Munich Accord.
Yeah.
Munich Accord, is because he's told by his Air Force, he says, we don't have the aircraft. For God's sake, do not start a war, because we cannot protect England. And they're all scared to death the bombers are going to come through, because remember, they have World War I. Remember the connection I'm talking about is that it scared the crap out of the British, that if bombers just came over in droves and dropped the huge amount of tonnage compared to Zeppelins and Gotha bombers of World War I, that their population wouldn't tolerate it. They'd revolt, and that would be the end of it. And Neville Chamberlain and the other guys might have cut a deal with Germany to say, okay, you've defeated France, we're out of this war. Okay, well, we have no place to go in the United States, right? And a lot of people in the United States do not like the Bolsheviks. So, and you know what? That guy Hitler is okay with us. Go crush Stalin and his guys, and they probably would have without any support. Stalin was not able to do this on his own. He admits as much. And anyone that studies the numbers can show that Lend-Lease saved their bacon. The Cold War would have been between Nazi Germany and the United States. And that's the difference. I think the Versailles Treaty helped, not guaranteed, but it certainly helped make it possible for us to crush Germany through the industrial might. And I think World War I's material schlock, the Germans called it the War of Industrialization, but it certainly applied to World War II as well in a big way. And that is what the influence to me of the Versailles Treaty has, is this sort of hidden background thing of what Germany was able to produce and not produce, and how much they could not produce in World War II. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions you've got. Or I already did? Okay.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, back to the Pacific. This is more pertaining to World War I naval.
Yeah.
The Japanese-Russian war, the naval fights.
You mean all the way back to 1905?
Yes.
Okay.
Did some of that by like British and the Germany and the United States look at that war and point, oh, we need to change how we think about our naval forces?
I am not an expert on the naval development in the early 1900s, but I can say that it was a shock when Japan's not, I mean, they just didn't defeat the Russian Far East, they just destroyed it. They even captured ships. Captured them, which is like, you know, unheard of. And the way that the Japanese did, the British trained, a lot of the ships were built by Great Britain. To them, the Japanese, and there's a wonderful video on YouTube about this, by the way, that's just one of the best computer graphic design things I've ever seen about the Battle of the Togo. Tsushima? Tsushima is a stunning, beautiful movie. I don't know why they did this, but the Japanese, of course, it's a big victory for them, and it's very important to them. If you ever go to a Togo restaurant and order a sandwich, you are literally eating at the descendants of Togo at the Togo. So it's a little curious thing about that. But I don't know what to tell you about. They're always changing the development of what the ships are going to be, the dreadnoughts, the battleships, and torpedoes and submarines.
Because I was thinking, maybe that's the reason why HMS Dreadnought appeared.
I don't know whether that war and that naval battle, anyone said that could happen to us, but I think that they used it as ammunition to justify whatever they wanted to build and develop, you know?
HMS Dreadnought appeared because all of the leading navies were thinking that way. We built dreadnoughts at the same time, and we just didn't get them out as quickly. Otherwise, they would have been called South Carolinas, not dreadnoughts.
Oh, okay.
All right. South Carolina came out at that time. The dreadnought came out at that time.
The advantage of the dreadnought is the Brits had turbines. That made dreadnought faster. She was 21 knots. That was Britain's industrial advantage.
Yeah, whereas the South Carolina was maybe 18.
Yeah. Oh, so it was more like speed compared to...
Well, it was the whole package. You know, dreadnought was revolutionary. And then the whole point was, why did Britain throw away its supremacy of the seas? Because now it's only got one of these, and everyone else has zero. That's not as much of a lead as Britain has 8 jillion, and everybody else has, you know, 200.
Yeah, exactly.
But the point is, everybody really got there. And then they were at a good moment to seize the lead they had.
In fact, the original idea was Italian. Cunaberti had the original idea for a dreadnought. The Italians wanted nothing to do with
it. It was published in James Fighting Ships.
Yeah, and so the British took it.